Well, do check out your Bibles. It's Proverbs chapter 5. Now, as we've seen, Proverbs is gateway wisdom. As these young men go out from the courts to the provinces, the speaker, Solomon, but God through Solomon, is trying to ready them for adult life. And one of the most distinct challenges of adult life and the change that you've had between being a boy and a man or a girl and a woman is going through puberty. And so the writer to the Proverbs addresses his son or those under his influence with specific comments in the area of relationships. Now, the Bible is absolutely clear on these areas, but it's also able to speak in a way which is helpful. So as we look through this this evening, we're not to look for a whole series of meanings to try and unpick it as in an explicit way as possible. That's not the point. He's deliberately speaking in pictures for us that are clear enough that we might understand what's being said without being titillating. That's the scriptures. It's got the line right. It's God's inspired word. And so as we look through this evening, I want us to think about what's going on as this young man steps out in life. So far in life, his dominant influence has been his parents. We could say it's a vertical influence. Father down to son. But as he goes through puberty and goes out there, suddenly he's hearing powerful voices on a horizontal plane. And the question for him is he going to listen to, you could call, the vertical warning and counsel, or is his ear going to be open to the whispers from the immoral woman? That is the question that this young man has to encounter. And so this evening, this comes to us. If you're a young man or a young woman this morning, this is super relevant. But as we shall come to see, whatever your age, this is super relevant. And the first thing I'd like us to notice this morning, in the first six verses of this passage, that there are two voices appealing to this young man. And the first voice we see in verses 1 and 2 is the secure voice of the father. It's a secure voice. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding, that you may keep discretion and your lips may guard knowledge. It's a known voice. It's a safe voice. And he's saying, look after this. This is discretion. This is knowledge. And in one sense, this young man, as he goes out, is in exactly the same place as Adam and Eve in the garden. Because think about the temptation that they received from the serpent and the warning they received from God. What did God say to the man and woman? He said, if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. And God was saying to them, trust me to know that the knowledge of good and evil is bad. Trust me and obey. That was God just saying, trust me on this. And that's what the Father's saying. Trust me on this. What did the devil say? He said, experience it for yourself. No good and evil experientially. That's what Adam chose, and he became evil. He experienced it. It was a disaster. And that's what the Father is saying to the Son. Listen to me about what's right and wrong in this area. You don't need to experience it. You don't need to walk in the way of death to experience it as being bad. And so the Father comes straight on to the second voice, not the secure voice of the Father, but the dangerous voice of the forbidden woman. And it's coming, isn't it? Like the serpent saying, experience this. God's keeping something from you. Your dad's keeping something from you. Why don't you want to experience this? Verse 3 says, the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. And you can imagine this young man, he goes through puberty. Suddenly, he senses a new stirring, new desires. I remember hearing a talk by George Verwer. Some of you know George Verwer is the founder of Operation Mobilization. And he was doing lots with young people, and he needed to talk very straight in this area. And I remember him saying, don't be surprised that these desires are strong. This is your creative power from God. Don't be surprised if these desires are strong. So these strong desires have come. And this voice that made no sense before when the boy was young suddenly is a temptation. And if we were just to pause for a minute and think about this, that dialogue is often where things start, which is why we watch flirty speech. That's where things begin. That's why we want to avoid the world songs. If you were to analyse at any point in about the last 50 years, the top hits, and you were to think, what message would you have about relationships from these hits? What would you be thinking? You'd be thinking, wouldn't you? You see it, you go, you do it. That's the kind of message that you're getting from the world. So why get them in your head? Otherwise, you're just putting the lips of a forbidden woman in your head. What does the father do here? The father lays the danger on the line. He says, look, honey is sweet, but the bee stings. In the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. There's a path, verse 5, that goes down to Sheol. We know Sheol is the grave. He's saying this is disaster. And because Proverbs is a spiritual book, the implication here is of hell. You're going down to the grave as wicked. Now, verse 6, different translations render in different ways. ESV has got it. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways wander. She does not know it. That idea is a contrast to chapter 4 and verse 26. Chapter 4 and verse 26. The father says, ponder the path of your feet. But this woman doesn't. She's just happy to go whichever way she feels like. And when it says her ways wander, can you think about someone who became a wanderer on the earth? Who was that? Cain. If you go down this path, think about Cain, this wandering life, wandering around as he wandered around and headed off to a lost eternity. That's the tragedy. And so the father, he said, here's the two voices, but he's straight back in there in verse 7. It's me you wanted to listen to. Now, O sons, listen to me. And do not depart from the words of my mouth. So remember these two voices, the voice of the father, this vertical voice, and the voice coming from the sides, the horizontal voice. And you might say, well, what's all this lesson about? And if you look to the rest of it, verses 7 to 23, you could say this lesson is all about sex. However, the Bible doesn't use that term. It doesn't use that term. Why does it not use those? Why does our world talk about things like sexual intercourse and uses these kind of terms? Because our culture thinks biologically. What does the Bible think? Relationally. Sometimes people teaching these things in science lessons will say something like, well, we're just teaching the pipes and the plumbing, someone else can do other things. Well, that is completely anti-Christian to the core. Because the Bible never talks about these things biologically or mechanistically. Think about the Old Testament. How would the Bible describe things? It would say, Adam, what? He knew his wife. That's the term it uses. And if it wants to use a term that was for something else, it might say, he violated her. The Bible's got different terms, but it doesn't use terms that we use in modern biology. Why? Because sexuality is relational, not biological. That is the emphasis of this passage. And so, as this passage goes on, and if we're just to get one thing from this evening's message, we were to see a contrast in the next section. From verses 7 to 14, we see the danger and disaster of the momentary embrace. The danger and disaster of the momentary embrace. And the writer is going to contrast it with the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace. They're the two things, the danger and disaster of the momentary embrace and the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace. And you might say, well, why am I saying momentary embrace rather than sex outside marriage and the marital embrace as sex inside marriage? Well, because what's going on here? Sex outside marriage has got no lifelong commitment, which is the Bible's only place for sexual relations. Well, then let's have a look at this danger and disaster of the momentary embrace from verses 7 to 14. Let's look at the cost. The father just goes, just says, look, this is what's going to happen if you go down this line, the line of whatever I feel, you've just got to follow what you think. Well, he goes on, he says, keep your way far from her. We'll think about that a bit more in a minute and see, why does he say, don't go near the door of her house? Why? What's going to happen? Verse 9, lest you give your honour to others and your years to the merciless. Well, there's danger and disaster there regarding independence. Honour is often used in the sense of finance in the scriptures, and you'll be swept away. You can think of it. What have we just seen in the news recently? Boris Becker. Man, how many multi-millions did he earn? Tens of millions. And still could earn huge sums of money as a commentator and coach. Where is he now? He's in jail for 2.5 years, serving time for fraud. Why did he get there? Well, one reason was a short encounter in a restaurant left him 20 million down, according to the Times. That's what he's warning about. Lest you give your honour to others and your years to the merciless. Danger and disaster emphasised regarding money in verse 10. Lest strangers take their fill of your strength and your labours go to the house of a foreigner. Again, immorality is expensive, however you want to look at it. Food, gifts, hotels, divorce. Very expensive things. And what's increasingly seen in our day, someone does something that is stupid. It could be sexting. It could be some form of relationship. And it could be something online. And then what do they leave themselves open to? Blackmail. And at various levels, that is prevalent in our society. It's disastrous. One moment in time, one moment of stupidity, things are gone. His father goes on. Danger and disaster regarding health, verse 11. At the end of your life, you groan when your flesh and body are consumed. We could certainly think about sexually transmitted diseases. Whatever you look in history, whether it's syphilis, whether it's AIDS, whether it's chlamydia, which I think is the most prevalent one today, these things are a way of disaster. Danger and disaster regarding health. Danger and disaster regarding peace of mind. Isn't this possibly the worst one? You say, well, you can have certain physical things, but this is what you're carrying around in your mind. Verse 12 and 13. And you say, how I hated discipline and my heart despised reproof. I didn't listen to the voice of my teachers or incline my ear to my instructors. Are the worst things, the flashbacks, the haunting frustration and thinking, if only I had listened. And this is why Proverbs comes very strong. Why does it say, verse 1, be attentive to my wisdom, incline your ear. Verse 7, oh my sons, listen to me. It's in Proverbs, it pleads and it pleads and it pleads. It says, listen to me, because they know how strong. You go away from mum or dad's, You go out there with other people, and there's a girl or a boy, and there's pressure, and there's a stirring, and there's a desire, and then you're in trouble. So he's saying, listen to me. Don't have that regret. Don't be in the position when you're thinking, how I hated discipline, and my heart despised reproof. Notice that my heart despised reproof. I was like, well, why are you getting me about this? Why do you warn me about this? Why do you go on about these things? Because the dangers are so disastrous. And that's why in verse 8 and 9, I said we come back to this. Look at how he started off. Keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of our house. Thomas Brooks said, it is our wisest and our safest course to stand at the farthest distance from sin. The best course to prevent falling into the pit is to keep at the greatest distance. He that will be so bold as to attempt to dance upon the brink of the pit will find by woeful experience that it is a righteous thing with God that he should fall into the pit. That's quite strong. That's not just saying you might fall, but it would be righteous before God if you did fall, if you want to dance on the edge of that pit. You might say, okay, well, what in New Testament terms, what does that mean? Turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5 verses 3 and 4 say this, but sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you as is proper among saints, lest there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. Same message. Don't even talk about these things. Don't joke about these things. Don't mention about these things. The things which might be placarded to us. Someone was saying to me recently that just they were looking down the list of television programs and they were just revolted by the things that were being celebrated on television. You can watch an advert and you can see things that are just revolting. It's just in your face. And so therefore, as believers, we're to come apart from that as much as we possibly can. Now, if you want a book recommendation on this, a man called R. Kent Hughes wrote a book called The Disciplines of a Godly Man. There's another book called The Disciplines of a Godly Woman, which is also, I'm told, good. I haven't actually read The Disciplines of a Godly Woman, so that's a lesser recommendation. But Disciplines of a Godly Man, R. Kent Hughes talks about hedges. You know the idea of a hedge? A hedge is something where, you know, the principle is don't fall in this area. So therefore, you put a hedge, a check to make sure you don't dance near the edge of the pit. Listen to four hedges that R. Kent Hughes recommends. He says, men, put discipline hedges around your life, especially if you work with women. Here's hedge number one. Refrain from, keep from verbal intimacy with women other than your spouse. Do not bear your heart to another woman or pour forth your troubles to her. Intimacy is a great need in most people's lives, and talking about personal matters, especially one's problems, can fill another's need for intimacy, awaking a desire for more. Many affairs begin in just this way. In other words, if you want a heart-to-heart, don't have one with the opposite sex unless you're married to them. That's what he's saying. This is a way of disaster. And you, like me, may know examples of where someone, even though they haven't completely gone, they've basically got involved in what sometimes is termed an emotional affair, and that's caused deep and lasting damage to their reputation and their marriage. Hedge number one that Hughes recommends. Hedge number two, on the practical level, do not touch. Do not treat woman, any woman, with the casual affection you extend to the females in your family. How many tragedies have begun with brotherly or fatherly touches and then sympathetic shoulders? You may even have to run the risk of being wrongly considered distant or cold by some women. Kent Hughes is saying, I'm just avoiding the problem. Number three, R. Kent Hughes says, when you dine or travel with a woman, make it a threesome. This may be awkward, but it will afford an opportunity to explain your rationale, which more often than not will incur respect rather than reproach. Many women business associates will even feel more comfortable dealing with you. It's called the Billy Graham rule. You may be aware there's a big controversy in the States with a man called Mike Pence when he was vice president, that he dared to hold the Billy Graham rule. There was something else about Mike Pence that they couldn't destroy. They couldn't kind of criticize his marriage, unlike the vast majority of the other people who were in the on Capitol Hill. So there's another hedge. Hedge number four: never flirt, even in jest. Flirtation is intrinsically flattering. You might think you're being cute, but it often arouses unrequited desires in another. It's an extended quote from here, but I'm just going to give you one last bit of view, so I think he hits the nail on the head. He says, be real about your sexuality. Do not succumb. Do not give in to vain Gnostic prattle about you being a spirit-filled Christian who would never do such a thing. I remember a man who indignantly thundered that he was beyond such sin. He fell within months. Face the truth. King David fell, and so can you. So that's Hughes being really, really blunt. Now, those things are recommended. Four hedges. They're not laws, but you, each one of you, need to think in your life, what are your boundaries? And if you haven't thought through your boundaries, you're in danger, because you need to know when it's a clear no, no further. So that's the negative, the danger and disaster of the momentary embrace. But returning to Proverbs 5 now, the father immediately says, look, you need to understand the reason why I'm saying so many negative things is because the positive is so good that the devil's trying to keep you from. The devil's trying to keep you from the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace. That's verses 15 to 20. Now, it's been well said that the devil has no creative power. He can't manufacture some new thing. All he can take is what God's good gifts are and twist it and pollute it. That's what he's done. That's a danger and disaster of the momentary embrace. And now we say the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace. It's a bit like a train. If you've got a train, you need the train running on the right tracks in the right direction, or it's going to crash. And here we have the train of legitimate desire running on the right tracks. Now, as we look through this, we will see two things. And firstly, about the security and satisfaction, we'll see in this section exclusive security and satisfaction. Look at verses 15 and 16. Drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be for yourself alone. Now, before the Reformation, there was an imbalance, which Paul himself criticized in 1 Timothy 4, verse 3, when some people said, sex is all bad, don't marry. That was what they said in the Roman Catholic Church. So what did they have? They had monasteries and nunneries. And what did you have by the time of the Reformation? Rampant immorality. Why? Because that's not God's plan. Hebrews 13 verse 4 shows God's plan when it says, marriage is honourable and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. That was what the Reformation recovered. The Reformation recovered that marriage was a good thing. And that the marital embrace wasn't just something that was necessary for procreation, for having children. Here we see, within the exclusive security and satisfaction of the marital embrace, the quenching of sexual thirst is something to be enjoyed. That's the emphasis of this passage. It is enjoyment, not having children. Now notice a phrase from verse 15. Drink water from your own cistern. That is something that's picked up on, or certainly that idea, in 1 Corinthians 7. 1 Corinthians 7 and verses 4 and 5. Paul says this. I will go back to verse 2. Because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband, for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So when the writer to the Proverbs says, drink water from your own cistern, this is in the context of the one flesh union, in the same way that Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians 7. Notice, it's a private cistern, not public springs. This is a one man, one woman, exclusive thing for life. Now, some people say, well, what's wrong with, whether you want to call it solo sex or masturbation, what's wrong with that? Well, what Paul says wrong with that? He says, your body is not your own. If you're a husband, you're in the one flesh union, your body belongs to your wife. If you're a wife, your body belongs to your husband. Your body is not your own. And sex is not primarily about pleasing yourself. It's about looking outwards to the other. And so here we're thinking about the exclusive and exclusive security and satisfaction. Look at verse 17. Let them be for yourself alone. These things are personal, private, and kept that way. That's the situation of the Bible. That's why it's the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace. It's God's good design. But it's not just an exclusive security and satisfaction, it's also an enduring security and satisfaction. Look at verse 18. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight, be intoxicated always in her love. Now notice he says two things. Verse 18, rejoice in the wife of your youth. And then it says, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Not just when she's young and beautiful, but as one older commentator said, when she's old and deformed. Now, we maybe wouldn't use that such language today. But the point he's making is exclusivity till death us do part. That's, if you just listen to the old marriage service is very, very clear on these things. It's enduring. It's from youth to old age, but it's also enduring. It's the idea is that it is regular. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. The time of the Reformation, again, the Puritans, they talk about due benevolence, that these things are to be regular. But it's certainly something that is personal. Again, this is more than children. This is a relationship which is enduring and lasting and thrilling. Be intoxicated, verse 19, it says here, with her love. It's something that is supposed to be overwhelmingly joyful. And so the author's saying, look, why are you going to look away from the marital embrace to the momentary embrace? Why do that? He's already had, there was danger and disaster by looking away, but there's also this security and satisfaction by following God's way. And therefore he immediately puts the contrast then, verse 20. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? So basically what he's saying is, look, my son, if you're presented with, and we could modernize it and say, if you're presented with, on a screen or in person, the bosom of a woman, whether it's because her clothes are too revealing or too tight, you must think, number one, that woman is not my wife. That's the first thing you should think. And if that is not our first desire, and not our first, sorry, not as not our first thought, and another desire is springing up in us, we need to ask God for his power in putting sin to death. That's the first thing we should think. That woman is not my wife, and we should pray that that would be increasingly our instinctive desire, instinctive thought. But second, we should be thinking the devil is using that woman, whether she knows it or not, to rob me of God's best. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? Well, where does he come to in conclusion? Well, he comes in conclusion by raising the stakes on the two voices. Remember, we've thought about the vertical, that was the voice of dad, and the horizontal, the voice of the woman. But now who do we see as the vertical? Look at verse 21. The stakes are raised. It's not just the Father, it's the Lord. For a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his past. There's that phrase again. Do you remember chapter 4, verse 26? Ponder the path of your feet. Then we've got the adulteress, chapter 5 and verse 6. She doesn't ponder the path of life. But now it says, it's not just you pondering and her not pondering, it's God pondering your path. The door might be shut, the curtains might be drawn, there might be no one there, whether it's whatever situation you're in, whether someone's with you or whether you're just there with the screen, he's saying God's watching. Then he says, the iniquities of the wicked ensnare him. He's held fast in the cords of his sin. He's trapped. If you want to have a description of someone hooked on pornography or someone who's hooked on relationships, there's a description. Ensnared, held fast. He dies for lack of discipline, but because of his great folly, he is led astray. Well then, where does this leave us in conclusion? Well, first thing we would say, you say, well, if you're young and you're thinking, right, I can see the danger of the momentary embrace, I can see the privilege and the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace, and if you are not able to stay single, if you don't think that's God's calling on you, then you need to be pursuing marriage. But that doesn't mean that you just can kind of go knocking on the door of the first father you see as a girl and you say, well, I'd like to marry your daughter. Why? Because I don't want to go for the momentary embrace, I want to go for the marital embrace. Well, the father will say, well, that's. I'm glad you're not going for that one, but you're going for this one. But there's one or two other things I'd like to talk to you about as well. Because this is only one part of marriage. It's a really crucial part, it's a central part, but it's not the only part. And by the way, can you provide for my daughter? And you're saying, oh, well, I was just in the Proverbs 5 sense. And so, if this is God's plan in marriage, then if you're a young man, you need to be thinking, I need to be working hard. 6 days you should labour and do all your work. You should be working as hard as you can with the gifts that you've got and the opportunities that you've got to get yourself in a position for marriage. And you can't turn around and blame God if you've been kind of like frittering away your opportunities or not working diligently and then say, well, why can't I get married? Why can't I find a woman to marry me? Why are the father saying not marrying him? Well, you've got yourself to blame, but don't have yourself to blame. That's what this passage would encourage you to get yourself in a position for marriage. But to use a second metaphor, while you're waiting, keep your garden locked up until marriage so that it can be entered without shame or regret. You don't want to be saying, I'm on the brink of utter ruin, verse 14, my reputation's gone, who's going to marry me now? You don't want to be in that situation. Keep your garden locked up until marriage so it can be entered without shame or regret. Thirdly, if you are married, keep applying this passage. Marital disasters are not restricted to those who are young. You hear today about what they call silver separators. That sounds a nice thing. All that means is you've been married for a number of years and then you're wrecking your marriage. You're just not doing it earlier on. So this passage speaks to married couples right through the ages, as we've already seen. But also, we shouldn't treat this passage in isolation. One of the commentators put it this way: the selfish man who treats his wife badly all day should not be surprised when his evenings don't fully meet his hopes and expectations. So again, we've got to look at this in the round. But overall, we've got to say, isn't our God good? Isn't our God good? In this world of chaos, in this world where again and again we see the danger and disaster of the momentary embrace, and isn't the people who depict it in Hollywood, aren't they some of the most wrecked people in our society? Don't we see that? And so we should say, thank God for the security and satisfaction of the marital embrace. Let's pray for married couples. If we're married, let's work at this. And if we're not married, let's ready ourselves for this, if that's God's will in our lives in terms of his gifting to us. And let's make sure that we remember verse 21, that a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord. He ponders all his paths. His eyes are on us. And he says, if you're going down the wrong path, remember, the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses you from all sin. Be cleansed, but move on to the right path. And what did Jesus say? Go and sin no more. Amen.